Sometimes a single incident throws into bold relief a whole nation's frame of mind. At their annual convention this year, the ladies of the Daughters of the American Revolution voted a citation to Wernher von Braun, ex-Nazi master scientist, the chief organizer of the unmanned rocket attack on London during World War II, now head of United States Army missile development at the Redstone Arsenal. These ladies voted this honor to von Braun, to use their own words, in respect to his significant spiritual contributions to American life. Now we smile at the maladroit choice of language which this citation reveals. And yet I wonder if all of us, if all Americans, have not been guilty of confusing our military scientists with our national saviors. And if all of us have not confused the achievement of peace by calling every rearmament proposal a step towards peace. Surely that has been axiomatic in American policy during the past decade and a half, that the road to peace can be secured only by ever more vigorous and energetic armament for war. In the last decade, we have spent as a nation over $500 billion in rearmament and preparation for war. The great debates of the past decade have been debates of military strategy, debates over the unification of the armed forces, over the priority of funds between manpower and unmanned military instruments, debates over limited war strategy as against global deterrence. The great public white papers of the last decade have been papers dealing with the questions of military strategy, the Cordner Report, the Gaither Report, and even the current report of the Commission on National Purpose reveals itself much more concerned with the areas of military strategy and military preparedness, what they call our defense posture, than they are with programs of peace, with blueprinting, the ways, the avenues by which mankind in our own nation can approach peace and security. A great key term of the past decade has been deterrence. We have been told, and we have told ourselves, that if we threaten the Russians with a rain of Holocaustial death-dealing proportions upon their cities, they will not dare to adventure militarily into lands which are not their own. And so we have armed ourselves to the teeth, and we have armed our allies, and we have armed our would-be allies, and we have armed some of the most mendacious, mischief-making adventurers of the world, all in the name of containment, all in the name of deterrence, all in the hope that the way to peace lies through creating a balance of terror, so frightening in its proportions that no nation will dare step beyond the bounds of international propriety. Now, reasonable men cannot question reasonable strength. But surely reasonable men must question a single-minded policy. For armament is essentially negative. It makes no major contribution to the settling of international tensions. It does not add one bit to a solution to international law and international government. Does not reduce armaments, does not reduce the threat of war, does not reduce the threat of some mad, insane act by a monomaniac general or dictator or government. Surely, No reasonable man, viewing the history of American policy during the last decade or so, can but arrive at this assessment. It has been single-minded, of single purpose, and that the few attempts we have made towards disarmament, arms control, the strengthening of the United Nations, the settlement of international disputes have been half-hearted, occasional, tentative, because they have lacked vigor, ultimately frustrating and self-defeating. All Americans were shocked Friday last to read in our newspapers of a tragic air collision over the city of New York. In that collision, 138 lives were lost. And already there has been built up in our public press and elsewhere a demand that the various concerned federal agencies and the airlines devote more man hours and more monies to the improvement and the refinement of techniques of air ground safety. Now, if atomic war were to break out, the experts tell us that we can expect 100 million casualties in the first 24 hours of that war. And they tell us further that by the conclusion of that war, we can expect 800 million casualties. Now, these figures are not mere rhetoric. They are the testimony of General James Gavin before a House committee. General Gavin is an officer of impeccable repute. He was head of research and development for the United States Army, and he had access to all known facts and secrets of our government. 800 million casualties in an atomic war. The destruction of human life as we know it. Surely one would expect that a world faced, a nation faced with such a danger, would have invested at least as many man hours, at least as much money in the prevention of a third world war as in the prevention of an occasional air tragedy. But the absurdity of our current position, the insanity of our current position is this, that we have invested less brain power, less manpower, and less monies in programs for peace than in programs for air safety. We are investing less money and less manpower, and there is less money and less manpower programmed and blueprinted for the near future. Somehow we presume that by luck, by good fortune, we will muddle through the dangers that beset us. The war itself is an absurdity. War in the terms of the atomic century is insanity. And yet surely reasonable men facing this position would have bestirred themselves to prevent war, would be bending their every energy to create a situation which would make peace inevitable, or if not inevitable, at least possible. But mark you this well. There are two federal agencies dealing with air safety. There is no federal agency dealing with peace. Our Atomic Energy Commission spent millions of dollars in the last 4 years to prove that none of the Russian inspection proposals against atomic testing were foolproof. But no governmental agency has spent a like amount of money investigating possible foolproof seismographic detection instruments. We have allowed our military to invest millions of dollars in the fashioning of a language of atomic euphemism, to teach us about clean bombs, to speak to us of limited war, to make us forget that any atomic weapon in our possession is nothing more than an indiscriminate agency of mass murder. No United States agency has spent cent one to tell the American people the simple truth that war is insanity, that War itself is defeat. That what we need is not only the power of deterrence, but such power as will prevent the necessity of our arms ever being unleashed. We need something to balance the negative fear policies of the present. And no agency is organized to investigate, to plan, to blueprint, to propose, to organize such proposals. So haphazard are our plans for peace that when the Russians surprisingly accepted at Geneva certain arms controls provisions which we put forth, we are forced to deny these very proposals because we claim that they were half thought through, that they were impossible of fulfillment. Indeed, so haphazard has been our planning for peace that it is my firm opinion the strongest position the Russians could take for their own selfish benefit would be to disarm and to demobilize and to face America with a unilateral position and condition of peace. We have no blueprint to change from a war economy to a peace economy. How will we absorb the excess productive capacity we have at our disposal? How will our already swollen ranks of unemployment absorb the millions of workers who will no longer be put to work in our defense industries, the millions of soldiers who will be demobilized from the military? How will our budget be able to adapt itself to programs and projects which would benefit the domestic side of our economy rather than the military? It is hard to see this transference from military to domestic policies taking place without a major convulsion within the American scene, a convulsion which, of course, our enemies would delight in. Now, I do not see peace imminent just over the horizon, but surely it would be tragic, would it not, if deep within us, within the ranks of labor and of business and of finance, there was a fear of peace, a fear of the transition to peace, such a fear as would immobilize us, prevent us from actively carrying out and persecuting and prosecuting programs designed to relieve world tensions. We need to think through the responsibilities of peace, the society which is peaceful, and to have an orderly program and blueprint of transition to such a society. Such is our condition. It is a mad world. It is a world in which we can no longer test the implements of war without threatening the health and the safety of mankind. It is a condition in which the very refinement of our instruments of destruction puts us at their mercy. Our scientists are today talking of what they call automatic deterrence. Missiles containing cobalt bombs aimed at all the major targets of our potential enemies, triggered to be blasted off not at a human command, but when delicate seismographic instruments reflect an atomic blast someplace in our own nation. The purpose of such instruments is to preclude the possibility that the commander may not be available to make a decision, and to preclude the possibility that a commander may be so horrified at the murderous potential of the instruments he is unleashing that even if attacked, he may refuse to make that decision. But presumably an atomic blast can take place in our own nation accidentally. Presumably some crazy, demented officer, overwhelmed by the tensions under which he must live at this edge, at this brink of the balance of terror, might set off such a bomb to organize and to initiate war. There would be no human way of stopping a war created by accident or by insanity, no way in which man could interpose himself, cut off the energies discharged by the electronic machines which he is so proud of having invented. We are the prisoners of our own machine. We have added to the danger of war by cruel purpose, the danger of war by accident. We are daily and yearly endangering ourselves by placing arms of unbelievable proportion in the hands of increasingly unreliable governments. A decade ago, there were two atomic powers. Today, there are five. Today, we are proposing to give atomic weapons to our NATO allies, which means to the West German government. If we do so, as surely as night follows day, Russia will counter by giving atomic weapons to the satellite nations and to the East German government. And there will we be faced with a situation where along the length and breadth of the European continent, in a continent which has never been able to organize peace, in a continent which knows how to manufacture incident upon incident, we will have placed in the hands of satellite governments, of petty dictators, the power of plunging the world into atomic holocaust. And as surely as night follows day, when these small nations gain atomic potential, other nations organized by the Lumumbas and the Castros and the Nassers of our world, will purchase on the black market these weapons, or will clandestinely be given these weapons. Then men who have nothing to lose, who have not one scintilla of sensitivity for human life, who seek only their maniacal aggrandizement of power, who have no sense of fellow feeling, no faith, no religion, these men will control, by virtue of their demonic power, the future of our world. Such is the condition of life today. A world enmeshed in its own armaments. A world which somehow or other continues blindly to pile armament upon armament, more damning bomb upon more demonic bomb, till it becomes a prisoner of its own creations. Until the power of war is not vested in the people or in the government, but in the instrument of death itself. Now, sensitive men have increasingly been coming to the position that war is an absurdity, war is an impossibility, and that we must organize, or rather reorganize, our thinking and our governmental activities to preclude the possibility of war. George F. Kennan, one of our leading experts in the Soviet, he was the original propounder of the policy of containment. He, as much as any American, is responsible for containment and brinkmanship and the military hysteria of the last 15 years. Speaking recently at Princeton University to Princeton seminarians, Mr. Kennan had this to say. This brings me now to the question on which I think a Christian might, with good conscience, really take a stand. These questions involve not just the national interests of individual governments, but rather the interests of civilization. The question of war and the atom, the other weapons of mass destruction. I am aware that the institution of war has always represented dilemmas for Christian thought, to which no fully satisfactory answer has ever been offered. I have in the past found myself unable to go along with the Quakers in their insistence on a sweeping renunciation of power as a factor in international affairs. I do not see the reality of so clear a distinction as they draw between domestic affairs and international affairs. The communists have taught us that these two things are intimately connected, that civil wars have international implications, and that international wars have domestic implications everywhere. I am unable, therefore, to accept the view which condemns coercion on the international sphere, but tolerates it within national borders. But that we cannot rule out force completely in international affairs does not seem to me to constitute a reason for being indifferent to the ways in which force is applied, to the moral implications of weapons and their uses. It is true that all distinctions among weapons from the moral standpoint are relative and arbitrary. Gunpowder was once viewed with a horror not much less, I suppose, than our atomic explosives today. But who is to say that relative distinctions are not meaningful? I cannot help feeling that the weapon of indiscriminate mass destruction goes farther than anything the Christian ethic can properly accept. The older weapons, after all, were discriminate in the sense that they had at least a direct, coherent relationship to political ends. They were seen as a means of coercing people directly into doing things an enemy government wished them to do, evacuating territory, desisting from given objectives, accepting a given political authority. A distinction was still generally drawn, furthermore, prior to World War I at least, between the armed force and the civilian population of a hostile country. Efforts were made to see that military action was directed only against those who themselves had weapons in their hands and offered resistance. The law of war did not yet permit the punishment of whole peoples as a means of blackmail against governments. In all of these respects, the atom offends. So do all the other weapons of mass destruction. So, for that matter, did the conventional bomber of World War II when it was used for area bombing. In taking responsibility for such things as the bombing of Dresden and Hamburg, to say nothing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, Americans went beyond what it seems to me the dictates of Christian conscience should have allowed. I regret, as an American and as a Christian, that these things were done. I think it should be our aim to do nothing of the sort in any future military encounter. If we must defend our homes, let us defend them as well as we can in the direct sense, but let us have no part in making millions of women and children and non-combatants hostages for the behaviors of their government. It will be said to me, this means defeat. To this I can only reply, I am skeptical of the meaning of victory and defeat in their relation to modern war between great countries. To my mind, the defeat is war itself. In any case, it seems to me that there are times when we have no choice but to follow the dictates of our conscience, to throw ourselves on God's mercy, and not to ask too many questions. Mr. Kennan, like so many of us, has come to the conclusion that war itself is the ultimate defeat, not the loss of the war. That we would destroy, wipe out everything that stands for civilization if the bombs were to fall and war was to be proclaimed. But one wonders at this practical man, this realist, this statesman, the fashioner of our present policies, who can find nothing more practical to blueprint for our future than to follow the dictates of our conscience, to throw ourselves on God's mercy, and not to ask too many questions. Are we so enmeshed in our own brainwashing that we cannot see any alternative to war but to throw ourselves on the mercy of the divine and not to ask too many questions? I think not. There are alternatives to war. There are ways that man can achieve peace if he has the courage, if he's willing to pay the price, he's willing to take risks. And it is this, on this last point that we Americans have been most guilty. We are afraid to risk anything for peace. It is a risk. A risk not to continue to test underground and in the upper stratosphere our weapons of mass destruction, to break the unilateral atomic test ban into which we were so grudgingly forced by Russian example. Perhaps the Russians are testing some bombs. There's no proof of that, but perhaps they are. But are we not willing to take this risk? When to take the other alternative of this dilemma is to plunge the world into an exacerbation of its current tensions, and to assure ourselves that we will be not only polluting the atmosphere of mankind with unhealthy ingredients, but that we will be precluding any further movement towards arms control, weapon testing bans. Oh, there is a risk. There is a risk involved in not giving atomic weapons to our NATO allies. NATO will be less strong rather than more if we deny them these weapons. But surely the risk is worth the gamble when the alternative is the arming of all of Europe, East and West, with atomic weapons. The exacerbation of European tensions, the sure and certain plunging of Europe into maelstromic political competition, ultimately war. Oh, there is a risk. There is a risk in creating a government agency which will speak of peace, which will undertake propaganda for peace, which will educate the American people to recognize that war is no alternative, that war is an impossibility and insanity. Perhaps we will become indolent. Perhaps we will give up the ghost, give up the fight. I think not, but there is that risk. But surely only an informed America, an American people who are made to recognize the absurdity of our present imbalance between programs of armament and programs of peace, only such an America can deliberately blueprint the future which holds any possibility for man. And I would advocate one risk more, a risk probably greater than any of which we have spoken. I should like to see our new administration proclaim on January next, when it ascends to office, a unilateral moratorium on all thermonuclear construction. No more building of atom bombs, hydrogen bombs, of cobalt bombs, or of the missiles which will project these bombs to their targets. As long as progress is being made at Geneva or wherever disarmament and arms controls talks are taking place. We have been at disarmament tables for 5 years. There has been little, if any, progress at these meetings. Why? Because each side has used these meetings for propaganda purposes. Neither side has shown its willingness to seriously prosecute discussions for peace. So acerbated has the situation become that no one trusts the other's words. Only deeds can now break this logjam and allow the river of realistic conversation and compromise and adjustment and treaty to flow with hope and peace for the world. As long as progress was being made, and I think that the Russians can be shamed into such progress, only as long as progress was being made at these tables should we take this risk. But surely it is worth the gamble, for surely it will give an opportunity for America to appear before the bar of world opinion and prove the honesty of our so often professed good intentions. Honesty, which the world has come to question, and with good reason. And ought we to read off the possibility of Russian agreement so easily or so completely? I wonder. Russia's aims are not our own. Russia's aims are selfish. Our own aims are selfish. But remember this, my friends. Russia has, in the past 2 years, been involved in a major philosophic and theoretical argument with its ally China precisely over the possibility of peace. And it is Russia which has insisted on the necessity of peaceful coexistence. And remember this also. It was not the United States, but the Russian government which unilaterally announced a moratorium on atomic weapons testing. We were shamed into it. They were the first to take that step. Russia has much to gain for peace. Domestically, she needs it. It is a risk. If there's something to gain politically by peace, we have no way of knowing that if a moratorium were accepted by the Russians, she would not violate it in secret, someplace in the inner recesses of Siberia, continue the construction of her arms. But surely the risk is worth the gamble. Surely only if we take such risks have we any hope of stopping this mad, headlong rush into self-destruction. Already in the West, sensitive men, brilliant men, men of the caliber of Bertrand Russell, Victor Golands, are telling us that the condition is so difficult, the times so dangerous, the West ought to adopt a policy of total unilateral disarmament. It is better to save life, they say, to save the basis of our civilization, than to maintain what we call our national honor and our national freedom. I do not believe that we have yet to choose between these two alternatives. We can have our freedom, we can have our national self-respect, and we can have peace. But there is more cogency to Russell's argument each year that we persist in not balancing and buttressing our haste in the direction of rearmament with an equal haste and sense of urgency in the direction of programs of peace. We can only pray that January next, when this new administration takes office, it will sound the clarion call to the American people, one which will speak not only of our military posture, but of our moral principles, not only of preparedness, but of peace. Amen.